So I just got done talking to one of my favorite thinkers. Literally just finished interviewing him, and I'm super stoked that I get to release this to you guys. His name is Bayo Akamaleke, and he combines his own wisdom from his indigenous heritage over there in Africa with sort of postmodern and post-structuralist ideas about the self and about the mind and about realities. With you know, he's also former psychologist, calls himself a recovering psychologist, I believe. And he just has all these really interesting ideas. He takes the climate crisis seriously. He takes capitalism and colonialism really seriously, but he also takes power really seriously. And he calls himself a libertarian, which if you follow this podcast at all, you'll know that I very much have strong streaks in that regard as well. So he's a super interesting guy. I really love how he combines the climate crisis with trauma, with spirituality, with sort of agnosticism and not knowing, and how he's very elegant and beautiful in putting that together. He was going to give me an hour originally, but he was running late because he forgot some equipment for the podcast for the interview. And that's okay, because even though this ran a little over half an hour, it's an extremely good interview. And I hope that you get something out of this. And if this is your first, you know, ever introduction to Bayo, definitely follow up with him, follow up with his work, read his book. I just jumped into more, I've been reading it, and I jumped into another chapter today. And it's one of those books that having read it and after sitting with it, you know, when you finish reading it, you really feel this sense of like wonder and wholesomeness as well, which I think these days is pretty rare. So look, with no more deliberation on my part, I'm going to hand over now, and I hope you get a lot out of this interview with Bayo. Bayo, maybe I'll hand over to you and we'll just get the conversation rolling.
My name is Bayo Akamalafe, and I'm speaking with my brother Nicholas in Australia from India. I'm grounded with my family here, with my wife and two kids, Kea and Alethea, and I like to speak sometimes annoyingly to my family, who roll their eyes ad infinitum when I do so. And teach and write, and a couple of other things. Yeah.
Beautiful man. So I don't remember when I discovered you. It was a couple of years ago. I'm one of these guys who's like plugged into podcasts all the time. I probably have some kind of an addiction going on there. And I remember one time I was driving down a pretty fast road, and I just had a random podcast playing in the background that you happened to be interviewed on. I was a fan of this podcast, and I wasn't paying attention, if I'm honest with you. I was barely paying attention. But then I heard you say something about it was either Deleuze or Derrida. And you said, you quoted Derrida, and you're like, the author is also, or the reader is also the author. And I remember
Derrida.
I was like, it was Derrida. There you go. I was like, man, this is super interesting. So I went back and I re-listened to that interview of you several times. I've since bought your book, and I just, I'm very grateful that thinkers like you are out there. I love, I mean, I resonate with a lot of what you say. The idea that things are way more complicated and way more interrelated than they appear. And you know, you don't shy away from the darkness either. It does, not everything has to be tied up with a happy, lovey-dovey bow. I get a lot out of that. So yeah, I just want to thank you for your work. And you know, I know that you don't have a lot of time, but I'd like to maybe just introduce my audience to you too.
Of
So,
course, of course.
yeah. Look, man, I'm happy to talk about anything, but some of the things that this podcast is focused on is mainly the political crisis we find ourselves in, different ways of being in this time and approaching it, and, you know, not looking for answers, but just sort of being wrong in interesting ways, you know?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's dive into it. I think that is deep. You started by noticing Bernie Sanders on my, and I think maybe that's a beacon for the kind of conversation that wants to happen between us. And yes, politics as usual, politics more than the usual, politics that is fugitive and revolutionary. Let's dive in there, brother. Let's see what wants to happen.
I'm not sure where you say this. It might be in your book, but you say that there's nothing we can do about the shadows that exist that will not itself create another shadow. Can we talk about that?
That makes sense to me in terms of, let me start from here. I think it's quite popular for people to refer to an entangled universe. This is not new. Ever since the field and discipline of quantum physics seeped into popular culture and was literally carried by New Age spiritualities, you know, it's been popular fare for people to refer to this idea that everything is connected with everything else. That isn't, and that isn't exactly new. It isn't even new if we only refer to quantum physics. Indigenous traditions have been speaking about this for some time. But there's something that is always missing in that analysis, especially when it's, you know, left at that. That entanglement is, you know, works by exclusion as well. That when bodies come together, or when assemblages, you refer to Deleuze, the French philosophers spoke about assemblages. That is, we live and thrive in networks, right? We are not, and Nicholas is not Nicholas. Nicholas is an assemblage of bodies, which are never still. This network is constantly shape-shifting, right? And Catherine Hales speaks about the non-conscious cognition. So in a sense, you don't think in your head, you think ecologically, territorially. When you put on your headphones, when you switch on your phone, when you switch on your laptop, you're switching on a network somewhere. So you're always diasporic. You're more than a local entity, right? So back to this idea of assemblages, that when we perform certain assemblages, we constitutionally rule out the possibility of being part of other assemblages, right? If you were to go to the dual slit experiment, the double slit experiment, you know, when the apparatus measures a particle, then it is ruled out a wave being measured. When it measures a wave, then it rules out a particle from being measured. So in a sense, the world works by exclusionary dynamics. That is part and parcel of what it means to be entangled. When bodies form, they cut out, in order to gain definition, they cut out some aspects of, so agential cuts is what Karen Berard would call it. Agential cuts are enacted to form definitions. And these definitions are not still or static. They're migrant, they're nomadic, they're constantly shape-shifting, which might lend some validation to that statement about shadows, that to live and to breathe and to move in the world is not to do so in a paradigm of absolute light, that we are constantly proliferating shadows. You know how we think about loss and death as something down the line. One day I will die. Hopefully it's when I'm 100 years old or 90 years old. Death, from a modern anthropocentric point of view, is an event to come, right? But when we see the world as relationally dynamic, as fluid, as processual, then death has already happened. Hmm. We're living in death. Death is a paradigm, an ecological modality. It's the creativity of the universe in shaping and unshaping, in feeling and unfeeling itself. So this tells me the shadows will always be with us. To suppose that there is a place we can arrive at where it's absolute light, totalitarian in its reach, no shadows anywhere, is to have arrived at the summit of Cartesian and Enlightenment yearning, you know, which is problematic ethically. So I think that's what I mean by that. Shadows will always be with us. And shadows are, in many respects, allies.
So this idea that the absolute light is actually a totalitarian impulse is super interesting one. And I know from following you that you have some strong libertarian leanings, and you know, that means different things to different people, but yeah. I would describe myself as some kind of a libertarian leftist or left localist, I don't know, something like that.
Right, right.
And I'm because of that, I don't really fit nicely into any box. You know,
you've fallen off the spectrum, right? You're just off the spectrum altogether.
That's left. I think that describes me to my friends and family very well, off the spectrum. Uh-huh. But, you know, I see that we're in a time of totalitarian politics is very fashionable, and it's not something that's purely on the so-called right. On the so-called left. It's everywhere. Yeah. And you know, we're all very desperate to draw very sharp distinctions. Very sharp distinctions about who is good, who's bad, who's right, who's wrong. And I do that as well. I fall prey to that. You know, I get emotionally, affectively sucked into that layer.
Yeah.
But I also remember that, you know, there is another way to think. And that's to sort of view all of this, at least my way of view, is viewing all of this as part of something, that this is a symptom of something that's going on, in the same way that when a really dysfunctional family is fighting over the remote control, it's not really the remote control they're fighting over, right? Yeah. It's they're fighting over power, and they're fighting over their inability to get along. And so I think there's a lot of shit happening right now, and the totalitarian impulse is very strong, and I don't actually see a way out of it. And maybe even coming up with a conclusion itself that's all-consuming is a totalitarian impulse in and of itself. I don't know. Can we riff off that? What do you think?
Yeah. I like that. There's something I've been saying about belief and the hidden life of belief. So I think the popular assumption is that if I believe something and you believe the opposite, then we are in totally different worlds. So fundamentalists, conservatives will believe that the world is stable, preset, predetermined, and has its values already, you know, baked in as part of its structure. Don't deviate from the idea that male and female are how everything started. You know, don't create a third gender. How rude. And then, you know, the progressives, which are not exactly the liberals, on anyone towards the left of the spectrum, towards the political left, believes, you know, different things, that the world is emergent, that the world is, we should create room for diversity of experiences and stuff like that. Now, these beliefs feel like they could never meet, like they're totally different ideas. And yet it is my contention, it is my submission that they are the same thing. now let me explain what I mean.
I love it.
It might be shocking. By the same thing, by saying they're the same thing, I hope to introduce some rhetorical force to what I'm saying. I don't exactly mean they're the same content-wise. I think we can discriminate, make out differences, and parse different meanings. However, I feel that beliefs transcend what we're aware of, right? That beliefs are not just what we're cognitively aware of, that beliefs are ecological strategies, right? That to say I believe something, and I think a professor, I think her name is Gendler, has been writing about Elif, A-L-I-E-F, something that is beyond just an instinctual way of believing or something. The idea here is belief is non-human. It's more than human. And an ecology could thrive or grow in such a way that it encompasses contradictory beliefs in order to strengthen itself. And I think you hinted at it by noticing how power, modern power, seems to be the magnetic center of the eternal wars between the so-called eternal wars between the left and the right. Cancel culture is behaving so much like the MAGA hat wearing conservatives, so to speak. And it's almost as if whoever is in power starts to behave in ways that you feel that's how the other person was behaving. I spoke with someone recently and he said that he's shocked that his fellow leftists are actually championing everyone should do what the authorities say. You know, everyone should not question, should not raise a single question about the vaccines, right. The coronavirus right. vaccines. Just stick your arm out there. And he's like, guys, we read 1984 together. What happened to all of that? What happened to all the suspicion of authority? So I feel that beliefs are not as anthropocentric as we take them to be. Beliefs are ecological. Beliefs are, and sometimes they could act within the same assemblage of power. And here, the issue here is modern power. Modern power being the liberal humanist project that presupposes that we are separate from the world. We are core identity projects. We are distinguished from others, you know, by the boundaries of our skin and our experiences, and there's nothing more to be said about that. So in terms of the kinds of politics we're seeing today, I think, like someone said comically once, that the left and the right are just as two wings on the same bird, if you will. You know, it's just and we don't know what to do with that. That's why we need a third way, an interruption of that ecological scenario. We need something transcendent. Oh no, not transcendent. Yeah, you can think about it as transcendent, but transversal is what I'm looking for, to shock the system for other ways of being and speaking and thinking to emerge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to go two different directions. And I guess one way is your conception of trauma in light of, you know, everything you're saying. And the other way is what post-activism, which is not a word you've used in this interview, but it's a word you use a lot, what that actually means or looks like to you. So just very small questions, you know.
Right. But I coined the term post-activism years ago. I don't have activist experience per se in terms of holding a placard and hitting the streets. I didn't grow up in that milieu. I grew up in in a world that was living in the wake of colonial surrender, basically. Whatever they dish us is what we should take. Whatever the West gives to us is what we should take. So I didn't grow up in that professional activist space, but I was increasingly drawn to it. And my world was also populated by people and activists and practices that seemed to have another dynamic altogether, another kind of formula. It's as if you called yourself an activist, you were just siphoning money from gullible white people, you know, very compassionate. You could create a project and say, we want to create build this for a school in a village here. And they would send money down. And that's what an NGO meant to me growing up. Those were the conversations that I heard, you know. And I think it reflects an understanding, even though it has been unvoiced, that maybe activism is increasingly part of the architecture of our incarceration. Mm. And behaves a lot like the world we are increasingly disenchanted from. So to those who are acting and striving and working really hard in whatever sector, because the term activism is not monolithic. It deigns or it pretends to capture a field of acting and concerns, a multivariate field of acting and concerns. But to those who are acting and trying to change the world in some particular way or the other, you know, this is what post-activism means for me, and I hope for them, that activism, I think, is not what we do. It's the doings we're already part of. we like to think about activism as it's for us. We have the agency, human beings, to enact change upon the passively recipient world, right? The world just receives our change. But I think it's increasingly costly and unsustainable to think that way. In these times of climate chaos, we're beginning to see that we are part of the world, right?
Mm.
And the world is part of us. We are not floating over it. So we are part of sticky assemblages of doings, you know? So I think about post-activism as that call to notice that the question is not so much or absolutely, what do we do about poverty? Or what do we do about climate chaos? I think there's another kind of question we can ask, and that is, what are we already doing, even though we don't have a language for it? Wow. What are we part of? You know, what streams of doings, whether non-human or more than human doings? You know, what if microbial activisms in our guts are are framing behavior in particular ways? How about we think about the transatlantic slave trade, for instance, as the activism of sugarcane as well? Mm-hmm. You know, we like to discountenance that from social dynamics. We say it's only humans acting upon humans that makes the world. No, the world exceeds human happenings and human conversations. So I'm asking, what other doings are we part of? By post-activism, I do not mean to say this is a more spiritual, more sacred way of doing activism that shall guarantee you results at the end of the day. If you only become a post-activist, I don't mean to create a new identity project, you know, or a new trending fashion and say, if you're a post-activist, you've ascended. What I mean to call into being is inquiry, mm-hmm. a political project mm-hmm. that seeks to listen and find other ways of deviating or falling away from the tried and true tracks of acting, of building different kind of coalitions in a weird kind of politics that isn't solely or absolutely about meeting other human beings. Mm-hmm. For instance, what if grief is one way to respond to climate chaos? What if tending to grief? That doesn't make sense from UNESCO's perspective. That doesn't make sense from UN's perspective. It's not a technological solution. It doesn't reduce carbon in any sense. But what if there are other kinds of activities and doings and agencies that we are being called to right now in a world that exceeds us? And so that's the gift and the calling and the idea of post-activism, that we are entangled and there is a place for different kinds of work to happen.
Mm.
Yeah, and you were saying something about trauma. Would you like me to respond to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, just sort of reflecting on what you had written in your book again, I'm just roughly quoting, I'm probably roughly misquoting. What stuck out to me is that you said that I noticed that behind the so-called pathologies and labels that all my clients had was actually a whole bunch of terrible feelings that were unbearable and they couldn't feel. And that a lot of the so-called mental illness is unbearable feelings that people, you know, can't feel for whatever reason. Very in line with what I think about a lot of the labels we put on suffering too. But yeah, what is your idea of trauma in light of your sort of, I don't know, like Deleuzian ontology, your sort of post-structuralist mm-hmm. and indigenous worldview? How do you see darkness and trauma? And does it get integrated or heal? Or is it, how can we be relational with that stuff, Bio?
I think if we cannot think about the human as, I think if we think the individual, which is a project of modernity, that's the fetish of modernity, the individual, self-sufficient unto himself, able to carry the weight of his own identity, you know, forget the village, forget my indebtedness to land and culture and generations. The individual is the fetish. If that is becoming increasingly impossible to think through, then we have to think, outthink the idea of trauma as merely what happens to us. I think trauma is not just the experience of suffering. I think trauma is also the politics that that prescribes how we behave or what suffering means, right?
Right.
It's also the narratives, it's the bodily formations, it's climate, it's how we eat, it's how we language what we eat. You could go on and on. It's not just singularly pain or the experience of pain, because it's not merely the case that subjects experience trauma, right? It's that trauma subjectivizes subjects. It's that we are made in the moment of that, in a nexus, in a place where politics and ecology and spirituality and theology meet and conspire and do something different. So here's the way I've been speaking about trauma, that I write about intergenerational trauma, racial trauma. But one thing I bring to mind is that trauma is not merely to be healed, you know, as if do this and you're healed, right? I think trauma is not just a passive thing. I think it's a creative, effective force.
Oh yeah.
It's a force, and it's like a rhizome. It's widespread and it moves like a murmuration. It enlists bodies and dismantles bodies and moves on its way. It's like global warming, you see, mm-hmm. the heat from the sun that is on the planet. But global warming is the scenario where because of all the greenhouse gases we're pumping into the atmosphere, it's trapped. And so the heat cannot go on on its way. I feel there's some kind of incarceration dynamic. There's a trap. We're trapped in a shape. And so we've caught all the heat together of trauma. We've caught all the heat of feelings, of horrible feelings, which we're constantly transacting with each other, whether mm-hmm. it's your experience or mine, mm-hmm. right? We're in molecular transfusions. We're infecting each other with feelings. And some scientists did some beautiful experiment speaking about atmospheric feeling. If feelings could be detected in the air, right?
Yeah, right.
So that feelings are not just what I feel. Feelings are more than human entities, right? So I feel that the shape we have assumed, the shapes of our cities, the shapes of our conversations, the shape of our bodies, and the way that we posture ourselves in the world has enacted a global warming of despair. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't room for trauma to move out. The trauma of the anthropological project, the trauma of modernity that is trapping and imprisoning the primal scream that seems to be infecting all of us at the heart of all of us. We want to scream because things aren't working, but we're just habituated into doing the familiar things over and over again. I think we're trapped. And I think what needs to happen is a crack. Is an opening, just a tiny opening for that heat to seep through. And that's what I call a shapeshift.
Wow. So, you know, in my language, what I'm hearing is, you know, because of the organizing experience of whatever this thing is that we're in, it's basically entrapping all of us in this affect that we're all sharing and co-participating in.
Yes.
That we can call trauma, and there's no escape at this time without some kind of a crack.
Yes. You know, to bring it home a little bit, I tell the story about the Hiroshima bomb blasts, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 1945, August 6th, August 9th. And how, as a result of that event, that tragic event, all of us, I think it's slowing down now, but I don't know. I don't have current empirical data, but as recently as the year 2000 or 2010, babies born were born with a little bit of that event.
Wow.
And what I mean by that event is the bomb blast, the atomic bomb blast, spat out carbon-14 into the atmosphere, which of course melted through water, melted through bodies, embedded itself in plants, embedded itself in animals. We eat all of that. So you can see how we're eating trauma. The trauma of that World War II event became ours to share that. We're still living in it today, even though it's not part of our experience. To a large, to varying degrees, we are sharing in the trauma of that moment. I think one can say almost the same thing about how we transact trauma. I call it transaffective assemblages. Mm-hmm. That is, we're constantly eating each other up, constantly feeding each other. And politics and the way we language the world has a role to play in how these sites, these territories become reinforced. So I'm really interested in a political project that is committed to the new. And to the new, I mean not just a new app or a new solution that is just a regurgitation of the familiar. I'm looking for ways that hack our claims to be human.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for ways out of the human, the man, you see, the man, the giant who stands supreme, suzerainty, you know, having suzerainty over the world. I'm looking for ways out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're to address our long-lasting trauma, which I think is part of cancel culture, which I think is part of the identitarian politics of today, not to say that that isn't of some value, but which is part of many of the things that we take for granted. If we could find or create or experiment with such a politics, it might bring us to a place that is a lot wiser than where we are now.
Yeah. Look, man, I know you got to go. I appreciate the chat. Is there anything that you would say to, you know, let's say someone, you know, is listening to this and they're thinking, that's all nice, but what do I do? Not expecting you to change any lives, but what advice would you give to someone just listening and they're caught in this whole thing right now? Maybe their COVID-19 affected them or something. What would you say?
Well, I would say, in a sense, we all have, well, I wouldn't say all, you know what I mean? All of us were touched by the pandemic, right? It wasn't equally distributed, of course. Many of us died. Many of us lost others. But I think in a sense, the world will probably never recover from 2020. And I don't know why I'm homing in on 2020, but it's fine. That seems like a crack in the fabric of things, like the threadbare place in the embroidery of unbothered continuity. That opening, that rift is tragic, but it is also an opportunity, is what I want to say to people listening. It's an opportunity for us to do something, to find other ways of being in the world. It's not easy to speak out of context. I don't situate myself as someone who can speak to everyone, regardless of your context. I'm really very shy about repeating any kind of colonial universality.
Yeah.
If this is a principle. But I think there is something about lingering with our wounded bodies that in times of crisis, when there is a fissure, a fault line, an opening in the ground, the thing to do is not to cover it up immediately, because that's where new gods come from. That's where new ways of speaking come from. If we treat cracks as research projects that we share with each other, if we treat that as sanctuary making, if we decorate our disarticulation, right? The fact that our bodies are splintering, if we share the fact that we don't know, right? The questions we are asking, like, what does it mean to go to school now? What does it mean to go to work? Who do we trust in these times? I think that's a very generative space. It's an opportunity. It's not easily resolvable. It's not easily resolved into this is who you shall trust and this is who you shouldn't trust. We are in very molten times. And what I want to say is there seems to be something, a strand of agency that is still left for us to claim, that we can do something about meeting the world anew. encountering the modern human beings that have always been around us. We risk running back into a normal. You know, we risk being saved. I don't want to be saved anymore, right? See, salvation is what the establishment offers to amniotic moments. What we want to do is to break free of salvation and create new worlds together. And that might be possible when we stay with our woundedness just a little bit longer than usual. So to end this, I'll just say, the obstacle is not what stands in the way. The obstacle is a place of generativity. If we head towards the obstacle, we might become finer.
Really appreciate the chat, man. Thank you so much for coming on.
Nick, thank you very much.